Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In the fall of 1992, Philip Roth took the stage of the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall to read from his yet unpublished book, Patrimony, as part of Portland Arts and Lectures. This was a pivotal moment in Roth's career as the publication of Patrimony set off a decade in which he won all four major American literary prizes for a string of books that would come to redefine his career. These awards included the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Penn Faulkner Prize, the National Book Award, and the Pulitzer Prize. So at this moment, Roth, already an important American writer, was on the cusp of becoming one of our greatest living authors who would chronicle American life as no one had ever done. What you're about to hear is a very special treat, as recordings of Roth reading are relatively rare, and he reads so effortlessly. In this tale about his dying father, Roth is by turns poignant and funny, profoundly insightful, and profanely irreverent. The sentences are as near to perfect as any prose writer could make them. His work has always been so deeply humane in its acceptance of our flaws, even while it soars with the sorrows and pleasures of what it means to live our brief lives. In 2012, at the age of 79, Roth announced he was retiring from writing. He has not written a book since. Here's Roth in 1992.
I'm going to read for about an hour this evening about a retired insurance manager who died of a brain tumor in October 1989, 88 years after he was born to immigrant parents in a slum neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey. This man was my father. In 1880, Newark was a prospering manufacturing city of about 100,000 people, Americans predominantly of English-speaking stock, as well as a sizable minority of German ancestry. Between 1880 and the start of the First World War in 1914, 2.5 times that number of foreigners, 250,000 immigrants settled in Newark. Close to a fifth of them were Jews from Eastern Europe, about 40,000. The rest were, in roughly equal parts, Italians, Irish, Germans, and Slavs. Two of these 40,000 Jews were my paternal grandparents, Sender and Bertha Roth. They came to America in the 1890s from a small town in Polish Galicia, not far from the provincial capital then called Lemberg. Today, Lemberg, that eastern outpost of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, is the city of Lviv in Ukraine, only recently Lvov in the Soviet Union. The Sender Roths, both about 30, arrived in Newark just about 100 years ago with three small boys and no money, not a cent. The language they spoke was Yiddish. My grandfather had been trained as a child to be a rabbi, and so he knew Hebrew as well. He got a job in a hat factory. The Roths' firstborn American child was my father, Herman, who, as I've mentioned, lived from 1901 to 1989. Like three quarters of the children of Newark's enormous new immigrant population, three quarters of them, my father did not attend school beyond the eighth grade. He left 13th Avenue School at the then legal school leaving age of 14 to work in the hat factory beside my grandfather. In 1927, Herman Roth met and married Bess Finkel, the American-born daughter of a marginally more fortunate immigrant family than his own, very marginally, and a recent graduate of an Elizabeth, New Jersey high school. The young couple borrowed money to open a small family shoe store. It went bankrupt only a few years later, around the time my older brother was born in Newark and the stock market crashed. Next came the Great American Depression, the repeal of Prohibition, the election of Franklin Roosevelt for his first term, and the triumph in Germany of the Nazis and their leader, Adolf Hitler. That's when I was born in Newark and when my father went to work as an agent for the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. For the Metropolitan, he canvassed the Newark streets house by house, flat by flat, basement by basement, 60 and 70 hours a week, sometimes longer, trying first to sell working people life insurance, and then, what was perhaps still more difficult, trying to collect the premiums from them so that the policies wouldn't lapse and he wouldn't lose his commission. His income derived mainly from commissions, and the commissions were not princely. At about the time I matriculated at college in 1950, a series of promotions by the Metropolitan culminated in my father's appointment as a district manager of one of the Metropolitan's smaller New Jersey offices, one with a disastrous sales record and a hapless, demoralized staff, including not a few heavy drinkers. But my father himself was a hard worker, a no-nonsense moralist, and a driving boss. And by the time he retired in his early 60s, he was managing one of Metropolitan Life's largest, most productive offices in the Northeast. By anybody's measure, he'd come a long way from the eighth grade classroom of 13th Avenue School. Neither Marco Polo nor Buzz Aldrin could have been any more astonished by the magnitude of their journeys than was my father when in his retirement years he looked back on where he'd begun and where he'd wound up. In 1987, 5 years ago, while my widowed father was vacationing in Florida with his companion Lillian Beloff, he went to bed one night, apparently in excellent health, and woke up the next morning to find the right side of his face was completely paralyzed. The lower lid of that eye bagged downward, revealing the lid's inner lining. The cheek on that side had gone slack and lifeless as though the bone beneath had been filleted. And his lips were no longer straight, but drawn down diagonally across his face, thickening his speech and making eating a messy bite-by-bite effort laden with frustration and embarrassment. Not until he got back to New Jersey early in the spring was the paralysis properly diagnosed. An MRI test revealed that it was caused by a massive brain tumor. The doctor called to give me the test results, and I drove over to New Jersey from New York, where I was living temporarily in a Manhattan hotel while my wife was working in London, to tell my father what the doctor had said. All this by way of introduction. What follows is taken from my most recent book, Patrimony. The book's subtitle is A True Story. The book's subject is My Father's Dying and Death, Reported Exactly as I Saw It Happen. The chapter I'll read from, chapter 3, is called Will I Be a Zombie? So, having arrived at his apartment to tell him about the tumor, I'd gone into the toilet where, while eyeing my grandfather's old shaving mug on a shelf beside the medicine chest, I'd rehearsed my lines for the 50th time. Then I'd come back out into the living room and looked at him slumped down in a corner of the sofa waiting for the verdict. Lil waited in the other corner of the sofa. She said to me, Philip, do you want me to go? Of course not. Herman, she said to him, do you want me to stay? But he didn't even hear her. And from then on, Lil was so silent, she might as well not have been there. Well, he said slowly in a very gloomy voice, what's the sad news? I sat in the chair across from him, my heart pounding as though I were the one about to be told something terrible. You have a serious problem, I began, but it can be dealt with. You have a tumor in your head. But Dr. Meyerson says that given the location, the chances are 95% that it's benign. I had intended, like Meyerson, to be candid and describe it as large, but I couldn't. That there was a tumor, it seemed enough for him to take in. Not that he had registered any shock as yet. He sat there, emotionless, waiting for me to go on. It's pressing on the facial nerve, and that's what's caused the paralysis. Meyerson had told me that it was wrapped around the facial nerve, but I couldn't say that either. It's a tumor, I said, but it's not malignant, and it's operable. He can operate if we want him to. Dr. Meyerson wants to speak to you about an operation, Dad. I think it's a good idea to go back and talk to him now that we know what's up. I think that all of us should sit down together in his office and see if an operation is feasible. Finally, it's going to be your decision. I then added, feebly, Meyerson says that it's a routine operation. Meyerson had indeed used that phrase at the close of our phone conversation the day before, and I had thought, sure it is, routine for you. Will my face get better if he operates? No, there just won't be any more deterioration. So this is the way I'm going to be. I'm afraid so. 2 minutes, and I had learned to talk like a surgeon. I see, he said, And then he fell silent, and then he was lost, alone and lost, and I wouldn't have been surprised if right then he had died. His eyes were looking out to nowhere, onto nothing, like someone who has just been fatally shot. He was gone like that for about a minute. Then, having absorbed the blow, he was back in the midst of the struggle, estimating the scale of his loss. And my hearing? What the tumor is damaged can't be retrieved. The operation, as I understand it, will prevent anything further from happening. Unless the operation were itself to make something further happen, but I didn't go into that. I would let Meyerson apprise him of the risks, as well as of the size of the tumor and the encasement of the facial nerve. Will it grow back, he asked. I don't know. I wouldn't think so, but you'll have to ask the doctor. Look, we'll make up a list of questions. You'll write them down, and you'll take them with you, and then you can ask the doctor everything you want to know. Will I be a zombie? I don't think Meyerson would propose this operation if he thought that could possibly be the outcome. But could it not be? Of the 15% who Meyerson allowed were worse off after the surgery, weren't they zombies, or close enough to what my father meant by a zombie? And what about the 15% who didn't survive the operation at all? Where is it? He asked. In front of the brainstem, that's at the base of the skull. The doctor will show you where exactly. I want you to write down all your questions so you can go over everything with him on Monday. I've made an appointment for us to see him and to talk this thing through with him on Monday. Of all things, he smiled. A wry half-smile, really, that worldly-wise, heartbroken smile that says, "But of course." He put his hand to the base of his skull and, feeling nothing unusual there, smiled again. "Well, everybody leaves this earth in a different way." "And," I replied, "everybody lives on it in a different way. Everybody's battle is different, and the battle never ends. It's going to be an ordeal. But if the surgery seems to all of us the right way to proceed, then 2 months from now, we're going to be sitting right here, talking, and you're not going to have that thing inside you pressing on those nerves." It was wretched being unable to believe my own words, but I did not know what else to say. I thought, 2 months from now, he'll be in a convalescent home, barely able to lift a spoon to feed himself his cereal. 2 months from now, he'll be a zombie in a bed somewhere, fed intravenously, whom I sit helplessly beside just the way he once sat with his dying father. 2 months from now, he'll be in the cemetery with my mother. In the meantime, he had gone off to the bathroom, and when he came out, he was talking about his appendectomy in 1944, when, against heavy odds, he had survived a dreadful bout with peritonitis. He was remembering how I had nearly died of a burst appendix and peritonitis in 1968. Then he was back in 1942, recalling my hernia operation at age 9, how he had taken me to see the family doctor after I had been in distress on a Sunday drive with the family. It was the second time in a month we had been to the doctor about my discomfort. I told the doctor, I insisted, this boy is not a complainer. There must be something wrong. And they told us there was nothing wrong. But I insisted and insisted, and eventually they found out I was right. I told Dr. Ira he should rest in peace. You remember our doctor, Ira Flax? Of course I do, I said. I was nuts about him. And my brother Charlie, he said, dying in my arms. Such a handsome man. All that energy. 4 children, and he died in my arms, Philip, the older brother I worshipped. And my Milton, my brother Milton. Remember Milton? No, I said Milton died the year before I was born. That's how I got my middle name. Milton, he said, 19 years old, a brilliant student, the shining light of the family, his senior year at Newark College of Engineering, on and on, remembering the illnesses, the operations, the fevers, the transfusions, the recoveries, the comas, the vigils, the deaths, the burials. His mind, in its habitual way, working to detach him from the agonizing isolation of a man at the edge of oblivion and to connect his brain tumor to a larger history, to place his suffering in a context where he was no longer someone alone with an affliction peculiarly and horribly his own, but a member of a clan whose trials he knew and accepted and had no choice but to share. In this way did he manage to domesticate his terror and eat his lunch. And that night, as he reported to me the next morning on the telephone, to get 6 continuous hours of sleep before waking in a sweat at 5 a.m. I was not so lucky. I couldn't find any context to diminish my forebodings. The thought of his undergoing an operation as awful as that at the age of 86 was unbearable. And if he even made it successfully through the surgery, the prospect of the recovery, and if something should go wrong during the surgery, I couldn't sleep for 6 continuous minutes. Zombie, a word I don't suppose I'd heard since as children, my brother and I used to go to see horror movies at the Rex Theater in Irvington. Zombie kept conjuring up the most hideous medical scenarios. The next morning, I phoned to ask if he wanted to go for a ride. No, he didn't want to go for a ride. But it was a beautiful spring day. We could drive up to the Orange Mountains. We could go to Grunning's for lunch. No, no. He was better off at home. I said I'd come over and we could take a walk. He didn't want to go for a walk. I said I'd buy some lox and bagels and drive over and have lunch with him and Lil at the apartment. Was Lil around? She was upstairs. Well, tell her to come down and we'll have lunch together. It wasn't necessary. Maybe not for you, I thought, but it is for me. And so I went out and bought lox, bagels, and cream cheese in a 6th Avenue deli and then got the car and drove over to Jersey. When I got there, he was sitting, as I had imagined, alone on the sofa, pitifully dejected looking. The shades were drawn, the radio music wasn't on, and it appeared as though he hadn't even bothered to borrow yesterday's newspaper from one of his spendthrift neighbors. As I began to unpack the food I'd brought, he told me he wasn't hungry. When I suggested that instead of eating right away, we go out and take a walk, he made a noise to indicate that he didn't want to. "Where's Lil?" I asked, turning on a lamp at about 11 in the morning. "Upstairs." "Don't you want to see her?" He shrugged. He didn't care either way. I hoped they hadn't argued. Though I wouldn't have put it past him, even at the time of his greatest need, to go to work first thing, on one or more of those many failings of hers that it had become his mission to eradicate. She ate too much and was overweight. She was cheap and wouldn't part with a dime. She talked for hours on the phone with a sister of hers he couldn't stand. She was always running somewhere, to this flea market to buy crap, to that flea market to buy crap. She took stupid risks with money he told her to stick into CDs. She did not drive a car to his satisfaction. The list was long, maybe even endless. Though, of course, at the beginning of their affair, it had been for him as it is for all of us. She had been perfect then. Even her flaws were beautiful. Yes, back then her physical proportions were characterized in rather more flattering terms than he would have used to describe them now. "She's like that painter," he told me. "You know who I mean?" I hadn't met Lil's yet, but I took a guess. "Rubens?" "That's the one," he said. "Well," I said, "Zoftik is nice too." "Philip," he said shyly, "I'm doing things I haven't done since I was a boy." "We should all be so lucky," I told him. Lil had moved into my father's Elizabeth apartment building shortly after the death of her husband and a year after the death of my mother, and lived there with one of her 2 stepsons, Kenny, whose financial acumen didn't entirely meet my father's standards. Not only didn't my father approve of how Kenny went about his business, but he didn't like the way her boss ran the auto supply house where she worked as a bookkeeper either. And when he told Lil as much, instead of retorting that he didn't know what he was talking about or that she didn't need his opinion, she sat, and she politely listened and courteously didn't talk back. And as I see it, this forbearance may perhaps have had more to do with what seduced him than did the Rubenesque amplitude that he soon came to see as a result of her continuing to eat much too much, despite his relentless upbraiding of her, meal by meal. course by course, helping by helping. Eating was her only revenge, and like the tumor, it was something he could not stop, no matter how he railed against it. "You and Lil have a fight?" I asked when I walked in and saw him by himself. "She's never around anyway, so what difference does it make? She runs here, she runs there. When she was sick, I took care of her. I waited on her hand and foot. The hell with her, let her go, I'm fine. I don't need anyone." "It's not my business to butt in," I said, "but is this really a good time to start an argument?" "I don't argue with anybody," he told me. "I never argue. If I tell her something, I only tell it to her for her own good. She doesn't want to listen, the hell with her. Look, put on a sweater and put on your walking shoes, and I'm going to phone Lil. And if she wants to come along, we're all going out for a walk. It's a beautiful day, and you can't sit around inside like this. I'm fine inside." I then spoke four words to him, four words that I'd never uttered to him before in his life. "Do as I say," I told him. "Put on a sweater and your walking shoes." And they worked, those four words. I am 55, he is almost 87, and the year is 1988. "Do as I say," I tell him, and he does it. The end of one era, the dawn of another. While he went to the closet and put on a bright red sweater and his white Adidas, I phoned Lil and asked if she'd like to take a walk with us. "Your father's going for a walk," she said. "Really?" "He is. Come, join us." "I suggest we go out for a walk. It'll do him good," and he jumps down my throat. "I don't mean to criticize, but that's the truth, Philip. You're the only one he listens to." I laughed, "and that may not last too long either." "I'll be right down," she said. The three of us walked together to the drugstore three blocks away, past the old apartment buildings and the new condominiums that were going up where the last of Elizabeth's opulent Victorian houses had once stood. Lil held him by one arm and I by the other, since walking had become very uncertain for him because of his poor vision. Only a few months earlier, he'd been patiently waiting for the cataract on his good eye to ripen so that it could be removed. Now, instead of looking forward to the minor surgery that would restore his vision, and with it, he confidently assumed, his robust independence, he was contemplating an operation on his head that could kill him. As we walked, he began to reminisce in a very rambling way. "My memory, it's no good anymore," he explained. But that wasn't exactly true. The sequence was often random and the focus sometimes blurry, but then the logic of his recollections could always be a little elusive, even at the best of times. He certainly had no difficulty remembering the names of people dead now 20, 30, and 40 years, or where they had lived, to whom they were related, and what they had said to him or he to them on occasions not necessarily that remarkable. Through my father's mother's line, we had belonged to a vast family network that had eventually organized into a family association in 1939 at the outbreak of the European War. While I was growing up, the association consisted of some 80 families in and around Newark and some 70 families in and around Boston. In 1943, Herman Roth had become the fifth family member and the second of his brothers to be elected president. His first vice president had been Harold Chabon of Roxbury, Massachusetts. Harold Chabon was the son of Max Chabon and Ida Flaschner. Harold's uncle was Uncle Sam Flaschner, the family pioneer in America. His second vice president was Herman Goldstein, who lived in New York. Goldstein was a hatter, loved to play cards with Leibowitz, had married Celia. All this was recounted to Lil and me as we began our walk down North Broad Street. "Our family association," he said, "back in those years, was one of the largest and strongest associations of its kind in the United States. It was the very tone in which he used to tell me as a boy that Metropolitan Life, his employer, was the largest financial institution in the world. We may have been ordinary people, but our affiliations were not without grandeur." "Out of nowhere," he said, "when my father sold the house on Rutgers Street, he sold it to an Italian family. Did he? How much did he get? What year was that? I was born 1901. They moved to Rutgers Street in 1902. We lived there 14 years, so it must have been sold in 1916. $6,000, that's what he got for it. The Italian paid him in nickels, dimes, and quarters. It took a week to count it. Only a week? I would think you'd still be counting. My father, he said, as we approached the drugstore to which my mother had taken the last long walk of her life 8 years earlier, my father had to beat my older brother Ed to prevent him from marrying a worldly woman. Had to beat him. My uncle Ed had been a bruiser with a short fuse who used to take me to football games when I was a child. His big hands and his broken nose and his rough, argumentative nature would thrill me for an hour or two, and I loved him. But I was always glad at the end of a day's outing that he was my cousin Florence's father. You never told me that, I said. Grandpa beat him? Had to. Saved him from that woman. How old was Ed then? 23? He first told me that story when I was 16 and in my last year of high school. I don't remember why he told it, but it was at dinner near the end of the meal, and I had jumped up from the table in a rage and then bolted from the room when I'd heard him conclude, "They don't have that kind of discipline anymore." My mother had come into my bedroom to try to get me to go back to eat my dessert. She had begged me to forgive him for whatever he had said that had offended me so. "Please, dear, do it for me." But I had been adamant and refused to return to spoon down Jell-O across the table from somebody who considered beating the love for a woman out of a 23-year-old man, even one as pig-headed as my Uncle Ed, a praiseworthy form of discipline. No doubt he had forgotten that incident, and so actually had I, until the moment 39 years later when for some obscure reason he had chosen to tell the story to me again. But there was no rage now against the storyteller. It was I, in fact, who now said to him, philosophically, "Well, they don't have that kind of discipline anymore." We were walking back now the way we'd come. He was silent for a while. Then, as though having glimpsed the solution to some intractable problem after a long and arduous effort, he began to say, "Yes, yes." "Yes what?" I asked. "I've been alive a long time." "You're the insurance man, you know the statistics," I said. "On the actuarial charts, you have achieved a great age." "Where is the tumor?" he asked for the second time in 2 days. "In front of the brainstem, at the base of the skull. Have you seen the pictures?" I didn't want him to think that too much had been going on without his knowledge, and so I lied. "I couldn't read him if I had," I said. "Look, it's operable. Remember that." But that was what he couldn't forget and dreaded most. "If we all decide that's the course to follow, then he'll go in and get it out, and after a brief convalescence, you'll be yourself again." "It would be nice to have a few more years," he said. "You'll get them," I said. I drove over again on Sunday morning, and he had a set of sherry glasses ready for me to take away, each glass individually wrapped in a page of the previous week's Sunday Star Ledger, and all of them wedged bulkily together in a shoebox. He never used them, he said. He didn't need them, and he wanted Claire and me to enjoy them in the country. Ever since my mother's death, each time he came to stay with us in Connecticut, he had something with him, in a paper bag or a shopping bag or in the little plaid valise that he carried alongside him during the 3-hour car ride with the local driver we sent down to Elizabeth to get him. Unlike the sherry glasses, it was usually a present for him and my mother from me or from Claire and me, that now, years later, he was returning, as though what they had been given had only been on loan or left there in storage. "Here are those napkins." Or, "Here are the placemats." Or, "Here are the steak knives." Or, "Here's the flower vase." or hear the coffee mugs. And in the beginning, when I resisted, explaining to him, but they're yours, they were gifts, he would reply with no idea that there might be a grain of insult lurking in all this unburdening, what the hell do I need them for? Look at this clock. A beautiful clock that somebody gave us. Must have cost a fortune. What good is it to me? The clock had cost about $200 in Hungary in 1973. I had given it to my mother, a little porcelain clock with a floral design of the kind she liked that I bought for her in an antique shop in Budapest on the way home one spring from visiting friends in Prague. But I took it back silently. Little by little, I took everything back. Struck each time by how inconsequential to him was the sentimental value, even the material value, of things intended to betoken the love of those he most cherished. Strange, I would think, to find that particular blank spot in a man on whom the claims of family were so emotionally tyrannical. Or maybe not strange at all. How could mere keepsakes encapsulate for him the overpowering force of blood bonds? Item by item, I took it all back like a well-trained refund clerk in a first-rate department store. But wondering if perhaps what he was thinking while he wrapped these gifts in old newspaper and stuffed them in cartons of every description was that this way we wouldn't have too many of his possessions to bother about after his funeral. He could be a pitiless realist, but I wasn't his offspring for nothing, and I could be pretty realistic too. This time, instead of silently accepting the goods being returned, I reminded him that I was still a transient in a New York hotel, didn't know when I'd next be home in Connecticut, and would just as soon have him hold on to the glasses. Take them, he insisted. I want to get rid of them. Dad, I said, setting the shoebox on the brake front where I assumed the glasses had been stored all these years, these glasses are the least of our worries. But rushing around the apartment looking for the next thing to get rid of, finding the glasses, packing them in newspaper, finding the shoebox, for a moment this had given the day a purpose, provided some little release for all that was brutally thwarted. Now there was nothing for him but to be frightened again. I was sorry suddenly for not having let him have his way and just taking the damn things back to the hotel. But I was getting frazzled, too. I've been like that all my life, he said, dropping unhappily onto his spot on the sofa. Like what? Impulsive. I was unused to hearing this kind of self-criticism from him, and I wondered if it was such a wonderful development. At the age of 86, with a massive tumor in his head, better to continue wearing at either side of his bridle those blinders that had kept him pulling his load straight ahead all his life. I wouldn't worry about it, I said. It isn't as if you're only impulsive. You can be cautious and prudent, too. You oscillate, people do. But he was being gnawed at by something and wouldn't be consoled. What are you thinking? I asked. I gave my tefillin away. I got rid of my tefillin. Why? They were sitting in the drawer. Tefillin are the two small leather boxes containing brief biblical extracts that an Orthodox Jew fastens to himself by narrow thongs during his weekday morning prayers, one box strapped to the forehead, the other to the left arm. Back when my father was an overworked insurance man, being a Jew for him hadn't had much to do with formal worship, and like most of the first-generation American fathers in our neighborhood, he visited the nearby synagogue only on the high holidays and when it was necessary as a mourner. Since his retirement, however, and particularly in the last decade of my mother's life, they had begun to attend services together mostly every Friday night. And though he still didn't go so far as to put tefillin on in the morning, his Judaism was more pointedly focused on the synagogue and the service and the rabbi than it had been at any time since his childhood. The temple was 100 or so yards down the road on a little side street off North Broad in an old house that was rented by the small congregation of elderly local people who were barely able to meet the upkeep costs. According to my father, a yeshiva student came over from New York to lead their services on the weekend. A 23-year-old whom my father called Rabbi, most respectfully, and spoke of as something of a sage. However humble their manifestations, these yearnings for a formalized religion in his old age were inspired by something far from hypocrisy or conventional decorum. In fact, the consolation that he seemed to derive from going to synagogue regularly, the sense of unity it bestowed on his long life, and the communion with his own mother and father, he told me he felt there, made his getting rid, as he put it, of the tefillin one of the more enigmatic instances of his lifelong habit of relinquishing, rather than saving, the treasured objects of the past. Given the link of sentiment that Jewish belief now seemed to furnish between the isolation of old age and the striving populist life that was all but gone, I could have imagined him, instead of parting with his tefillin, rediscovering in the mere contemplation of them something of their ancient fetishistic power. But my imagining this old man meditatively fondling his long-neglected tefillin was so much sentimental kitsch, really. A scene out of some Jewish parody of Wild Strawberries. How my father actually disposed of the tefillin reveals an imagination altogether bolder and more mysterious, inspired by a personalized symbolic mythology as eccentric as Beckett's or Gogol's. "Who'd you give the tefillin to?" I asked him. "Who? Nobody." "You threw them out in the trash?" "No, of course I didn't." "You gave them to the synagogue?" "I didn't know what you did do with tefillin when you no longer wanted or needed them. But surely I thought there would be a religious policy for discarding them overseen by the synagogue." "You know the why?" he said to me. "Sure." 3-4 mornings a week when I could still drive over there, I'd swim, I'd kibitz, I'd watch the card game. And, well, that's where I went. The why. Go on. I took the tefillin in a paper bag. The locker room was empty. I left them. In one of the lockers. The halting way he revealed the details, the bafflement he himself seemed to feel looking back now on this original plot he'd devised for their disposal, prompted me to wait a little before asking anything further. "I'm curious," I finally said. "How come you didn't go to the rabbi? Ask him to take them off your hands." He shrugged, and I realized that he hadn't wanted the rabbi to know what he was up to, for fear of what the 23-year-old whom he so respected would think of a Jew who was ditching his tefillin. Maybe he'd never even thought of the rabbi, as perhaps the shrug was meant to indicate. Maybe it was just revealed to him in a flash, the knowledge that in that secret place where Jewish men stood unashamedly naked before one another, he could lay his tefillin to rest without worry. The understanding that where his tefillin would come to no harm, where they would not be profaned or desecrated, where they might even be re-sanctified, was in the midst of those familiar Jewish bellies and balls. Perhaps what the act signified was not his shame before the young rabbi in training, but a declaration that the men's locker room at the local YMHA was closer to the core of the Judaism he lived by than the rabbi's study at the synagogue. That nothing would have been more artificial than going with a tefillin to the rabbi, even if the rabbi had been 100 with a beard down to the ground. Yes, the locker room of the Y, where they undressed, they schwitzed, they stank. Where, as men among men, familiar with every nook and cranny of their worn-down, old, ill-shapen bodies, they kibitzed and told their dirty jokes, and where, once upon a time, they'd made their deals. That was their temple, and where they remained Jews. I didn't ask why he hadn't turned them over to me. I didn't ask why, instead of giving back to me all those napkins and tablecloths and placemats, he hadn't given me the tefillin instead. I wouldn't have prayed with them, but I might well have cherished them, especially after his death. But how was he to know that? He probably thought I would have scoffed at the very idea of his handing on his tefillin to me. And 40 years earlier, he would have been right. I didn't ask because I realized that to do so was truly to place the two of us back inside that corny scenario I couldn't seem to cut myself loose from. Somewhat improbably, where his tefillin were concerned, it was I whose imagination kept running to the predictably maudlin, while his had the integrity of a genuinely anomalous talent, compelled by the elemental feeling that can lend ritualistic intensity to even the goofiest act. "Well," I said, when it was clear that he had no more to tell me, "one of your pals there must have got a big surprise when he came up from the pool. He must have thought a miracle had happened." There he'd left his shower clogs in the bottom of his locker, and lo and behold, they'd been turned into tefillin. He didn't as much as smile at what I'd said, maybe because he didn't get it, or maybe because he did. "No," he replied in all seriousness, "the locker was empty." "When did you do this?" "In November, a couple days before we went to Florida." So he had more than likely been thinking this: if I die in Florida, if I never come back, no, the tefillin must not wind up in the garbage. "Then November 30th, he said, "we flew to West Palm. I carried my suitcases from the baggage place all the way to the taxi stand. That's how good I felt. And the next morning, my first morning in Florida, I woke up and this had happened in my sleep. My face, paralyzed." Yet again, he was pushing the fallen cheek up with his fingertips to see if this time it would stay. "I look in the mirror, I see my face, and I knew my life would never be the same. Come here," he said, "come to the bedroom." In the bedroom, where the mahogany bedroom suite no longer gleamed with polish as it had when my mother was in charge of the housekeeping, where instead you could now initial the dust cutting the upper surfaces, my father showed me in the middle of the top bureau drawer the little metal box where he kept his will, his insurance policy, and his savings books. There was also a record there of his CDs and municipals. "All my papers," he said. "And here, the key to my safe deposit box." "Okay," I said. "I did what you told me," he said. "I made all my savings accounts joint with Sandy." He took out the savings books, there were four of them, to show me where my brother Sandy's name now appeared beneath his as the account owner. Flipping through the savings books, I saw that the savings added up to about $50,000. The CDs and municipals came to another $30,000. They, too, were to be left to my brother. "The $10,000 insurance policy goes to you," he said. "I know what you told me, but that I had to do. I wasn't going to leave you nothing." "Fine," I said. When I was visiting him in Florida some 2 or 3 years after my mother's death, the subject of his will had come up, and I had told him to leave all his money to Sandy to split as he wished between his two kids and himself. I told him that I didn't need any money and that what Sandy's young sons got could make a big difference to them if the money was divided two ways or three at the most. I had meant it when I said it, I had confirmed it in a letter to him afterward, and I hadn't thought about his will since. But now, with his death anything but remote, being told by him that he had gone ahead and, on the basis of my request, substantially eliminated me as one of his heirs, elicited an unforeseen response. I felt repudiated. And the fact that his eliminating me from the will had been my own doing did not at all mitigate this feeling of having been cast out by him. I had made a generous gesture that was also, I suppose, of a piece with the assertions of equality and self-reliance that I had been making to my father since early adolescence. Admittedly, it was also a characteristic attempt to take the moral high ground within the family. To define myself in my 50s, as I had in college and graduate school and later as a young writer, as a son to whom material considerations were largely negligible. And I felt crushed for having done it. Naive and foolish and crushed. To my great dismay, standing with him over his last will and testament, I discovered that I wanted my share of the financial surplus that, against all odds, had been accumulated over a lifetime by this obdurate, resolute father of mine. I wanted the money because it was his money and I was his son and I had a right to my share. And I wanted it because it was, if not an authentic chunk of his hard-working hide, something like the embodiment of all that he had overcome or outlasted. It was what he had to give me. It was what he had wanted to give me. It was due me by custom and tradition. And why couldn't I have kept my mouth shut and allowed what was only natural to prevail? Didn't I think I deserved it? Did I consider my brother and his children more deserving inheritors than I? Perhaps because my brother, by having given him grandchildren, was more legitimately a father's heir than was the son who had been childless? Was I a younger brother who had suddenly become unable to assert his claim against the seniority of someone who had been there first? Or, to the contrary, was I a younger brother who felt that he had encroached too much upon an older brother's prerogatives already? Just where had this impulse to cast off my right of inheritance come from? And how? How could it have so easily overwhelmed expectations that I now belatedly discovered a son was entitled to have? But this had happened to me more than once in my life. I had refused to allow convention to determine my conduct, only to learn, after I'd gone my own way, that my bedrock feelings were sometimes more conventional than my sense of unswerving moral imperative. During the walk we took that afternoon, in which I steered my father very slowly twice around the block, I was not able to tell him, however much I wanted to, and however efficaciously humbling a confession of error might have been, that I would like him to reassign to me the share of his estate that he had originally bequeathed to me in his will. Let it be, I thought. It's almost worth the dough to be able to savor, yet again, the comedy of your own automatic brand of elevated stupidity. But if it was too late, or for me just too difficult, to lay claim to my original share of the money, I knew what it was I wanted in its place. But I then discovered myself unable to ask for that. Not directly, anyhow. Self-reliant to the last, independent to the end, the son perpetually protesting his autonomy. I don't need anything. Tell me about Grandpa's shaving mug, I said. I was looking at it in your bathroom. Where was his barbershop, do you remember? I had spotted the shaving mug that had once been my grandfather's in my father's bathroom the previous morning when I'd come over to tell him about the tumor. In it, my father kept his razor and a tube of shaving cream. The mug was pale blue porcelain. A delicate floral design enclosed a wide white panel at the front, and inside the panel, the name S. Roth and the date 1912 were inscribed in faded gold Gothic lettering. The mug was our one family heirloom, as far as I knew. Aside from a handful of antique snapshots, the only thing tangible that anyone had cared to save from the immigrant years in Newark. I had been intrigued by it ever since my grandfather had died a month short of my 7th birthday, and it made its way into our Newark bathroom, back when my father was still shaving with a bristle brush and shaving soap. Sender Roth, my grandfather, had been a remote, mysterious presence to me as a small boy, an elongated man with an undersized head, the forebear whom my own skeleton most resembles. And about whom all I knew was that he smoked all day long, spoke only Yiddish, and wasn't much given to fondling the American grandchildren when we all showed up with our parents on Sundays. After his death, the shaving mug in our bathroom brought him much more fully to life for me. Not as a grandfather, but even more interestingly then, as an ordinary man among men, a customer of a barbershop, where his mug was kept on a shelf with the mugs of the other neighborhood immigrants. It reassured me as a child to think that in that household where, according to all reports, there was never a penny to spare, a dime was set aside every week for him to go to the barbershop and get his Sabbath shave. The shaving mug inscribed S. Roth had seemed to free my grandfather, if only momentarily, if only for those few minutes he quietly sat being shaved in the barber's chair late on a Friday afternoon. From the dour exigencies that had trapped him, and that I imagined accounted for his austere, uncommunicative nature. His mug emitted the aura of an archaeological find, an artifact signaling an unexpected level of cultural refinement, an astonishing superfluity in an otherwise cramped and obstructed existence. In our ordinary little Newark bathroom, it had the impact on me of a Greek vase depicting the mythic origins of the race. "Tell me about Grandpa's shaving mug," I said, as we walked together slowly down the street. "His barbershop. You remember it?" "Of course I remember. Bank Street. Below Wallace Place, where the German hospital used to be, on the corner of Wallace Place and Bank Street. There was a barber on Bank Street, and when I was a little boy, we used to go around and get my hair cut, and my father would get a shave. The mug had S. Roth and a, what do you call it on it? A date. And they kept it for him in this barber shop. How'd you come to get it? How did I get it? That's a good question. I don't think I did. No, I didn't. I took it from my brother Ed. Yes, when we moved from Rutgers Street, Pop took it with him to Hunterdon Street and went to the barber on Johnson Avenue and Avon Avenue, and then Ed took it after Pop died, and I took it from him. I think it was the only thing that was ever left to me. And it wasn't even left to me. I took it. "You wanted it," I said. "I wanted it," he told me with a laugh, "since I was a little boy." "Want to know something?" I said. "I did too. I used to go get a shave with Bill Eisenstadt. He should rest in peace. You remember Bill?" "Of course. Bill, Lil, and their son Howie. A barber on Clinton Place, right around the corner from the high school. Cost a quarter. You leave it to Bill to find the last quarter shave in Newark." From Bill Eisenstadt, he went on to invoke Abe Block, and Max Feld, and Sam Kay, and J.M. Cohen, the totemic male figures out of my earliest childhood, insurance men with him at the Metropolitan, pinochle players in our kitchen on Friday nights, companions with their wives and kids on the Memorial Day picnics up at the South Mountain Reservation, the veteran foot soldiers with whom he had gone out collecting door-to-door in Newark's most impoverished neighborhoods. There would be families, he now told me, still paying premiums 20, 30 years after the death of the insured. 3 cents a week, that's what we collected from them. How come they kept paying? They never said anything to the agent. Somebody died, they never mentioned it. The insurance man came around and they paid him. "Amazing," I said. Though it was by no means the first time that I was hearing his stories of the long evenings collecting pennies from Newark's poor. Stories from 38 years with the Metropolitan, with Bill and Abe and Sam and Max and J.M. Cohen, all of them, as he reminded me several times, long gone. And of the few friends alive, there wasn't much good news to report either. Louis Chesler's in a hospital pissing blood. Ida Singer is almost blind. Milton Singer can't walk. He's in a wheelchair. Turo, remember Dick Turo? He has cancer, poor guy. Bill Weber doesn't even know who I am when I call up. Herman who? I don't know any Herman. Thus, he managed not to dwell entirely on his tumor, speaking instead of the old dead and the dying, and those of his friends who would have been better off dead. The next day, I drove to Elizabeth to pick my father and Lil up and take them over to University Hospital in Newark. He was to consult there about an operation with Dr. Meyerson, who was reputed to be among the best brain surgeons in Jersey. Meyerson, a plain, plumpish fellow in his early 40s, was gentle and extremely amiable right off the bat. When he'd settled in behind his desk, he looked across to where I was sitting and asked what questions I had. I pointed to my father, looking awfully glum in a chair between Lil, whom the doctor had called Mrs. Roth, and Meyerson's chief nurse, who we were told customarily sat in on preoperative consultations. "My father has the questions," I said. "Go ahead, Dad. Ask Dr. Meyerson everything you want to know." All those questions about the operation that he'd been asking me during the last several days, I had told him to write down and bring with him for the consultation. He'd written them in pencil, laboriously laid them out in that artlessly sprawling yokel handwriting, capitalizing most of the nouns, but spelling all except one or two words correctly. He'd showed me the list before we left the house, and I had thought, "I want this list. The list and the shaving mug will do it." My father removed the piece of lined paper from his pocket and unfolded it on his lap. "One," he began, "what's the procedure?" He looked up at Meyerson. "Pardon my ignorance, doctor." Meyerson reached behind him, and from a shelf with half a dozen medical texts carelessly flopped over at one end, took down a small painted plastic model of the brain and the skull. Turning it in his hand and pointing with a pencil, he explained where the tumor was situated and where it was pressing into the brain. He showed us on the back wall of the skull where he could cut through to go in to remove it. "We'll just lift the brain a little here and take out what's growing underneath it," he said. The thought of his lifting my father's brain staggered me. I hadn't believed you could do such a thing to a brain without inviting disaster. And for all I knew, you couldn't. "What do you use to go in there?" my father asked. "General Electric or Black and Decker?" He had been looking so ancient and so vanquished that I was surprised by his mordancy and the objective courage it seemed to attest to. The doctor's reply demonstrated his own quiet objectivity. "Surgical companies make the tools," he said. My father returned to the next prepared question. "Two, will it grow back?" "Eventually it might," Meyerson said. And now it was he who was mildly, mordantly ironic. "Maybe in 10 or 15 years we'll have to do it again." My father registered the point wryly with a single slow nod. "Three," he said, returning to his list again. "How much pain is there?" "Nope, there isn't much pain," Meyerson told him. "You'll be pretty sick afterward. You'll have a high fever. You'll be very weak." Meyerson's nurse, a slight, peppy, middle-aged woman wearing ordinary street clothes, no less pleasant and genial a person than the doctor, put her hand sympathetically on my father's and said, "We'll try to get you up and sitting 5 or 6 days later." In response, my father simply mumbled, "Oh boy." 5 or 6 days, unable to lift himself off the bed, gave him the picture if he hadn't got it already. He didn't give out, however, but proceeded to his fourth question. "How long does the operation take?" "Anywhere," Meyerson replied, "from 8 to 10 hours. He managed to take that in without flinching, which was better than I did. 8 to 10 hours, then 5 to 6 days. And what would he be worth after that? After the impoverished childhood and the limited education. After the failure of the shoe store and of the frozen food business. After the struggle to gain a managerial role in the teeth of the Metropolitan's Jewish quotas, after the premature deaths of so many loved ones, after all that he had weathered and survived without bitterness or brokenness or despair, wasn't 8 to 10 hours of brain surgery really asking too much? Isn't there a limit? The answer is yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes, to the thousandth degree. This was asking too much. To isn't there a limit? The answer is no. Most of the operating time, Morrison explained, is spent getting in through the skull. It depends then on the kind of tumor I find. In that area, 95%, 98% are benign. There isn't much bleeding generally. If there is, because of the nature of the tumor, that can slow things up a little. But on he went, the stoical father whom I had never admired more in his life. 5, will I have to learn to walk again afterward? Yes, Morrison said. And just when I had thought that I had the picture, I realized that not by any means had I grasped as yet the awfulness of this thing. Yes, Morrison said, you probably will. There were another 5 questions written down on the piece of paper, but even my father had heard enough. Pushing the list back into his pocket, he looked directly at Morrison and said, I've got a problem. You do, Morrison agreed. We drove back through Newark in silence. He had nothing more to ask. There was only that final exchange in Meyerson's office for all of us to think about and think about. I've got a problem. You do. At the apartment, Lil went into the kitchenette to prepare some Campbell's soup for lunch. My father went in after her to get the dishes to set the dining room table, and I sat in the living room trying to envision how Meyerson was going to lift my father's brain without damaging it. There must be ways, I thought. Lil was apparently using the manual opener screwed to the wall beside the sink because I heard my father telling her, hold the can from the bottom. You're not holding it from the bottom. I know how to open a can of soup, she said. But you're not holding it right. Herman, let me be. I am holding it right. Why can't you just do what I ask you when I ask you? It isn't right. Hold it from the bottom. And from the other room, I had all I could do not to shout, you're on the brink of a catastrophe, you idiot. Let her open the can any way she wants to. Though I was also telling myself, of course, how to open a soup can. What else is there to think about? What else is there that matters? This is what's kept him going for 86 years, and what, if anything, is going to get him through now? Hold it from the bottom, Lil. He knows what he's saying. Admittedly, he went overboard about how she was heating up or failing to heat up the soup. After setting our 3 places at the table, he returned to the kitchenette and stood next to her over the saucepan. She kept insisting the soup wasn't hot yet, and he kept insisting it had to be. It didn't take all day to heat up a can of vegetable soup. This exchange was repeated 4 times until his patience, if that is the word, ran out, and he pulled the pot off the burner and, leaving Lil empty-handed at the stove, came into the dining room and poured the soup into the bowls and onto the placemats and over the table. Maybe because of his bad eyes, he didn't see the extent of the mess he'd made. The soup was cold. Nobody said so. He probably didn't even notice. Halfway through the silent meal, he said, matter-of-factly, this is the last chapter, but kept spooning soup into his lopsided mouth until his bowl was empty and his shirt looked as though he had been painting with the soup. As I was leaving to go back to New York, he went into the bedroom and returned with a small package for me. A couple of brown paper bags had been savagely twisted about to accommodate the contents, and then bound together with varying lengths of scotch tape, most of which were coiled up on themselves like strands of DNA. I spotted the wrapping as his handiwork, and I recognized his penmanship as well. With a magic marker, he had written in uneven block letters across the top fold of the wrapping, from a father to a son. Here, he said, take this home. Downstairs in the car, I tore off all the wrappings and found my grandfather's shaving mug. Thank you.
That was Philip Roth speaking as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 1992. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.